With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Welcome back to day two of the Tutor Summit. I am super excited to introduce our first speaker today, Leanda Delisle. She was born in Westminster in London and read history at Somerville College, Oxford University, before taking up national newspaper and magazine columns and later publishing best-selling Tudor and Stuart history books. After Elizabeth, the death of Elizabeth and the coming of King James was runner-up for the Saltire Society's first Book of the Year award. Her next book, the New York Times bestselling biography, The Sisters Who Would Be Queen, The Tragedy of Mary Catherine and Lady Jane Grey, provided the nonfiction basis for Philippa Gregory's 2017 novel, The Last Tudor, and was described by Professor John Guy as gripping and an unrivaled account. Tudor, the Family Story, 1437 to 1603, is a biography of the dynasty and a Sunday Times top 10 bestseller, and her latest book, Winter King, is a biography of Charles I and his loss of three kingdoms. Based on her new manuscript discoveries with many never-before-seen royal letters, it describes a brave king who, like the tragic heroes of Greek myth, falls not because of wickedness but because of human flaws and misjudgment, and it reveals the true role of his remarkable and maligned queen. She regularly writes and speaks on matters for historical TV, radio, and a number of publications, including The Times, Daily Mail, Mail on Sunday, Daily Express, BBC History Magazine, History Today, The Literary Review, and The New Criterion and The Spectator. So welcome to Leanda Delisle, who is going to share with us lots of new information about Charles I. And I think that's one of the first things I want to ask you about. There's this idea that Charles is a bit of a failure, we just kind of remember him for his ending. And your book dives into a lot more the human part of Charles I. Can you share with me a little bit about why you chose him and as a subject and kind of how you feel about him, I suppose?
Well, you know, obviously I love the Tudor period. I've written three books about the Tudor period. But a lot of the drama and the stories of the Tudor period only really find resolution during the reign of Charles I. So doing the Tudors without doing Charles is a bit like not reading the end of the story in a way. And it's an incredibly exciting and moving story, and one that's got fascinating women in it who have been overlooked. And Charles himself, as you say, he's had this reputation. He's the failed king who, you know, was executed at the hands of his own subjects. But there was a story before then. You know, all our lives take different paths. If we had turned left instead of right, if we'd done this instead of that, how different our lives might have been. Charles wasn't destined to failure. It happened. It happened in the end. And it was a tragic story for him and for his kingdoms.
And you talked a little bit about the continuation of the Tudor story, and it does seem like the themes around the questions of where the power is with Parliament or the King, it reaches obviously its culmination with Charles. Can you talk a little bit about that struggle and how it started during the Tudor period and then kind of what Charles inherited then?
Gosh, well, there's sort of two aspects to this, one of which is religious, the Reformation, and the other which is political, the relationship with Parliament. And of course, they are linked. And so each of the Tudors changed the religion of their country, each of the later Tudors, that is, you know, from Henry VIII. Henry VIII created a kind of particular Henrician Catholicism. Then you had Edward VI, who introduced a kind of Calvinist Protestantism. Then you had Mary Tudor, Catholicism, and so forth. Mm-hmm. Each of them brought in their own. When Charles came along, he also wanted to define the Church of England in a particular way. And a way actually that would have suited Elizabeth I very well. But although we think of Elizabeth as a very strong queen, she was, as we also know, in a very weak position, because she was a woman and she was childless. And so she wasn't able to impose her particular vision for the Church of England on the kingdom in the way that Charles felt he could. Mm-hmm. And he liked a kind of what we would think of as a kind of high church form of Protestantism rather than a more stripped down form. And that angered many of those who preferred the more stripped down version. And then you've got, okay, politics. So that's religion. And then you've got politics. Politics, Parliament was... Again, when Elizabeth became queen, because she was a woman, there was a very strong feeling, particularly actually amongst Protestants, that a woman couldn't rule, that a woman had no right to rule over men, that there were biblical injunctions against it. And so they argued that, in fact, it wasn't really Elizabeth who was ruling, it was her in Parliament, her with Parliament. Sovereignty lay with the monarch in Parliament. The Stuarts argued against that and said, no, sovereignty lay with the monarch. And one of the reasons they did that is that taking sovereignty away from the monarch had encouraged people to believe that they could be justified to assassinate any monarch or any ruler they didn't approve of, whose religion they didn't approve of in particular. And so you had Protestants assassinating or trying to assassinate Catholic monarchs, and you had Catholics trying to assassinate Protestant monarchs. The Stuarts argued that actually kings had a divine right to rule given by God, and that no one had the right to just go around murdering them, essentially.
Yeah. and then he had a hard time getting money from Parliament and funding everything, right?
Yes, he did, because from the beginning, he had some difficult opponents, and they are also very much linked to the Tudor period. So those of you who love the Tudor period will remember the Earl of Essex, who was Elizabeth's last great favourite, but who died a traitor executed on the scaffold. He revolted against her. Anyway, his nephews and nieces play a sort of leading role in my book, White King. Two brothers in particular, Robert Rich, Earl of Warwick, who was one of the first, you know, who was a great sort of privateer against the Spanish, and also very interested in the early colonies of what later became the United States. Places like Warwick, Rhode Island are named after him. He was involved in the Pierce Patent with the Mayflower. He was involved with Virginia, Massachusetts, and all these things. He was essentially a Puritan, or a supporter of Puritans, a more sort of low church form of Protestantism that Charles was trying to change. Mm-hmm. So he was a very strong opponent of Charles. And if Charles didn't do as he wanted, or he felt Charles had policies that Warwick didn't approve of, then Warwick would encourage his supporters in Parliament not to give Charles the taxes he needed to, for example, pay for his armies who were fighting in Europe at one point. He had a younger brother, the Earl of Holland, Henry, Earl of Holland, who was actually the king's closest body servant, but then betrayed him at the outbreak of civil war. Mm-hmm. And then they had a cousin. They were all nieces and nephews of Essex, the famous Earl of Essex, called Lucy Hay, Countess of Carlisle, who's a great character as well, and who's a great friend of the Queen's, but also then turns enemy.
Mm-hmm. Right. So actually, I realized I kind of got a little bit of ahead of myself, and I was wondering if you could give me kind of a brief overview of Charles's life and kind of how he was raised to be king, and how it, I guess, just kind of his, a little bit about his wife and who he, just his life leading up to the mess that he got into. And then we can talk a little bit about how things turned so badly for him.
Right. Yes. Okay. So, he was born in Scotland when his father was still just King of Scots. He was just a baby when Elizabeth I died and his father inherited the throne of England and became the first King of Scotland and of England. He was a very weak, sickly baby, and he's in fact left in Scotland for a year and didn't come down to England until 1604, a year after Elizabeth had died. He had a sort of lingual deformity, so he probably couldn't eat or drink milk properly, and he had weak legs. And people often look back on this and they sort of use it as a kind of symbol of sort of weakness of character. And it's funny how we still have these strange patterns of thinking where disability or deformity are seen as weaknesses of character. Mm-hmm. So if anybody saw the last Wonder Woman film, for example, you'd have noticed that Wonder Woman, the heroine, is a beautiful, perfect physical specimen, and her enemy, Dr. Poison, also a woman, is disfigured. I mean, it's extraordinary we still think like that, but we do. But anyway, so this is sort of used as a stick to beat Charles with. But in fact, Charles was very determined to get over his disabilities. And I think what is more interesting than the fact that he had them when he was a boy is that he worked very hard to overcome them. And by the time he was a teenager, he was an extremely strong runner and was becoming a very good horseman and was extremely fit. He taught himself to speak eloquently with singing lessons and pausing before he spoke. So he wasn't garrulous. He was quite concise and witty. He was a funny man when he spoke, but he didn't go in for long speeches because he had a childhood stutter. He had an elder brother who died. In fact, Charles was at his deathbed, very pathetically, watched his brother die when Charles was 12, I think, just 12. Yeah. They were treating, essentially, the doctors were treating this boy's tuberculosis by tying a dead pigeon to his head, which obviously wasn't very effective, so he died. At which point, so he's still quite young, and we have to remember that Henry VIII was also a younger son. Mm-hmm. So people make a lot of Charles being a younger son. Henry VIII was a younger son. It wasn't a big deal. Elder brothers died. That's right. What happened in those days. James then raised Charles to rule as a ruler. He inherited the throne when he was almost 25. He was very energetic. He wanted to take Britain into the 30 Years' War in Europe to fight in the Protestant cause and in the cause of his sister, who was caught up in the wars in Europe. The so-called Winter Queen of Bohemia. Mm. And to this end, he married a French princess because he wanted to use French armies to help Britain, Henrietta Maria, who was only 15 at the time, a young girl. And their marriage is a bit like, I don't know if you remember the old, probably don't, the old Mills and Boone novels. I remember as a teenager, but they were kind of romance novels. And in these kind of, you know, cheap romance novels, the love affairs always start with a couple hating each other. They're always, you know, there's always quarrels. They never like each other, you know. And then, you know, then one day they fall in love for whatever reason, you know, they overcome their sort of. And that's always how these romantic novels always used to work, these Mills and Boone romance novels. And, Charles and Henrietta Maria's marriage was very like this Mills and Boone novel in that it starts with them quarrelling, just not really liking each other or getting on. But then you have to remember they were very young. I mean, this is a teenage girl, Henrietta Maria, 15 years old, taken away from France, surrounded by people who don't much like her because she's French and a Catholic.
And a Catholic, yeah.
Yeah, which is important, of course. And but, you know, Charles and Henrietta Maria do fall very much in love and have many children together. It proves to be a very strong marriage. Charles has strengths as a king, but also weaknesses. His weaknesses are that he lacks ruthlessness. He dislikes violence. At one point, Charles says that, you know, and cruelty. He says only cowards are cruel. But, you know, he is in a cruel and violent age. So he lacks ruthlessness in dealing with his enemies, whereas they are quite ruthless, more ruthless than he is. And also he's a poor politician. He's almost slightly autistic. I mean, he doesn't read people terribly well. He doesn't have an instinct for people. So it takes him a while to learn to trust people. When he does, his trust is complete. And he tends to lump all his enemies together rather than saying, oh, well, you know, they don't have things in common. I can play them off against each other, or I can persuade them round. He doesn't have that political sense, really, which is definitely a weakness. And it ends with, you know, him having terrible quarrels with his parliament. His leading minister, the Earl of Duke of Buckingham, is murdered. And then, you know, he rules without parliament for 11 years. And this ends when he... And it's all going reasonably well for him at that stage, but it ends when he tries to impose his version of Protestantism, his more ritualistic form of Protestantism on Calvinist Presbyterian Scotland. You know, you don't push around the Scots. You know, it's a small country, but, you know, it's a small kingdom, but, you know, they're tough as nails, the Scots, as we all know. And they didn't take kindly to this and rebelled. And that was really the beginning of Charles's downfall.
And can you tell me a little bit about his wife? Because she was quite the strong character as well. And when, after he was in prison, she went and tried to fight for him and everything. Can you tell me a little bit about her?
Yes. In fact, she's going to be the subject of my next book. She plays quite a strong role in this one, because she is a very remarkable character. Her father was the great warrior king of France, Henri IV, who was murdered, assassinated by a religious fanatic when she was just a baby. So her first experience, actually, of a ruler was her mother, was a woman, her mother, who ruled as regent for her brother. As I said, she arrived in England when she was only 15, still very young and very so much a sort of typical teenager, you know, strong-tempered, you know, get very distressed, you know, when her husband decides to sort of send all her friends back to France and she was left all alone in England, you know, and she would sort of cry and weep and sort of be very annoyed. Strong character, a colourful character. But then, you know, she matures, she's a highly intelligent one as well. She's had a bad press because basically her history has been written largely by her enemies and by contemporary propaganda. One of which is that, you know, she led Charles astray.
Yeah.
I think it's very, you know, this is a story that goes back to Adam and Eve, that we, the women, you know, we are terrible seducers, poor men, you know. You know, we wander around looking a bit pretty and then, you know, they do terrible things at our behest. Yeah. But, you know, behind the pretty mask is, you know, the sort of devil, you know, like the witch in Snow White or whatever.
Like a she-wolf, like Margaret of Anjou or any of these.
Absolutely, exactly. Margaret of Anjou treated very much the same way. I'm also a huge fan of Margaret of Anjou. Love Margaret of Anjou. But anyway, yes, absolutely. Whereas in fact, she was extremely supportive of her husband. She wasn't involved so much in English politics. Up to a point, she was involved in English politics. Mainly, she saw herself as a protector of the Catholic minority, which was persecuted. Mm. She was, after all, a Catholic herself. But as the Civil War drew closer, then she stepped up to the plate, really, because Charles needed her support at this stage. You know, she had to help him. So she left for Europe to raise money for him, to raise an army for him. She brought back an army from Europe. She actually, you know, was with this army under shell fire. There's an amazing description of her with men being blown to pieces yards from her. You know, she was with this army when it won battles. She was an extraordinary woman. And then when she had to leave England, she even had a baby while she was out there seeing Charles, you know, unbelievable, really. She had to abandon this baby to go back to France, where she continued to, you know, work for her husband's cause, right up until the restoration of her son. So she was an amazing woman. Yeah. Well worth reading about.
Yeah, well, we'll wait for your book on her then to give us a little taster there. They were very much devoted to their family and their children. And, you know, it seems like so much of your book talks about the way the children were handled, because they were separated then, and some of them were kept prisoners, I suppose. And can you talk a little bit about kind of how they functioned as a family? And there's that moving scene before Charles is executed, when he's saying goodbye to his children. And can you talk just a little bit about him as a father?
He was obviously an absolutely devoted father. It's very touching. So before the Civil War, you know, he, and there are descriptions of Charles and Henrietta Maria taking their children to the park and playing with them. Mm-hmm. You know, he would measure them, he would measure their growth on a sort of staff. He kept pictures of them, paintings of them by Van Dyck, you know, all around him in his personal quarters. Mm-hmm. He was obviously devoted to his children. Then, as you say, during the Civil War, they were, he was with his two elder sons at the beginning. They were still tiny. James was 9. I think Charles was 12, 11 or 12. Charles, the future Charles II, this was. Mm-hmm. And they were accompanied him in battle. I mean, they were at Edge Hill with him, the opening battle of the Civil War. Again, you know, with shot going over their heads. So the two younger boys were spent quite a lot of the Civil War actually with the king. The others often, particularly the youngest ones, imprisoned by Parliament. Mm-hmm. Then when Charles himself became a prisoner, he was able to see his younger children, his youngest children again. Parliament let him see them. There are incredibly moving descriptions of him playing with them sitting on his lap. You know, he adored his little daughter, Elizabeth, who later died when she was still young in Parliament's care. Mm. And as you say, then there's the horrendous description of his last meeting with the younger ones, which I don't think I can even speak out loud now, because I'll start blubbing, you know. It's so awful, and so moving, him talking to these children the day before he's executed, and he's got these sort of pathetic sort of last gifts for them. Mm. And he tells his youngest son, Henry, you know, that they're going to chop off his head. His own head, and that he mustn't. They will try and make him a king, and that he mustn't be king. He must be loyal to his elder brothers, who have escaped by this stage, and are in Europe, and whose right precedes, you know, Henry's right. Mm-hmm. And the little boy's about 5 years old, and he sort of says that he'll die first rather than, you know, do as Parliament says.
Very, very moving. Yeah. And that kind of then takes me to his trial, or that he was found guilty. What he didn't put up any kind of defense, did he? He just said that he didn't recognize the court, or, you know, and how on earth did Parliament, how did they justify trying a king?
Well, it's interesting. They had tried one monarch before in very different circumstances, and that was Mary, Queen of Scots. Sure. Now, Mary, Queen of Scots, was beheaded for treason against Elizabeth I. Now, the fact was that she was Queen of Scots. She wasn't an English subject, and therefore they had no right to chop off her head for treason, because she couldn't commit treason against another queen. Yeah. But so they had twisted, you know, history and fact and the law, really, to argue that, oh, Scotland was a subservient nation. Mm. I don't think the Scots would have agreed with that. and so that in some way that she owed fealty to Elizabeth, and therefore they could chop off her head, which they did. Mm-hmm. With Charles, it was a bigger problem. He was, you know, England's ruling monarch. Treason was an act against the king, not by the king, in English law. Right. So again, they just sort of changed the law, really. They just said that actually, no, treason was something you could commit against the people and against Parliament, and that sovereignty lay with the people. And so they just basically changed the law. And also they'd abolished the House of Lords, which was, you know, the highest court in the land. And the Commons had made themselves essentially a court.
Yeah. And then they had to make it retroactive so that it was...
Yes, they did, absolutely. Hmm. I think, but what they hoped was, they hoped... because actually the new model army was really in charge, because they'd purged Parliament, of course. They'd got rid of all the MPs they didn't like. The members of Parliament, they didn't like that, actually come in with armed men and had just got rid of, you know, don't like you, don't like your views, don't like your views, you can stay, you can stay.
Yeah.
So it wasn't really a proper Parliament in any normal sense. It was really sort of managed by a sort of military dictatorship, essentially. But they still hoped that what would happen would be that Charles would recognise the court, that he would probably be found guilty of treason against the people, whatever. But then Parliament would be able to pardon him. Mm-hmm. But he would have, by having recognised the court, he would recognise the superiority, the sovereignty of Parliament and of the Commons in particular. And then they could put him on the throne, essentially as a puppet king, as a constitutional monarch, you might say.
Right.
That's what they hoped. But Charles... would not recognise the court. And because he wouldn't recognise the court, they were left with no option, really, but to chop off his head. That's why Charles argued that he was dying as a martyr for the law and for the people, as well as for his religious beliefs, because he said that Parliament, the court, were breaking the law, and that he was standing for the law. That's why he claimed to be a martyr for the people.
It seems like it was kind of a game of chicken that got out of hand for them.
I think that's exactly right. It was. It was definitely. I think Charles misjudged, as he often did misjudge things. He misjudged their ruthlessness, and their game of chicken didn't work. Yeah.
No, it didn't. And I also want to ask you, there were some other very strong women involved in this period, like you talked about Lucy Carlyle, and can you share a little bit about who she was and some of these other people who were kind of on the periphery around him when he was in prison and playing their roles?
Oh, yes. Well, okay. Well, Lucy Carlyle's a great character. She is, again, a niece of the, you know, Elizabeth I, last favourite, the Earl of Essex, mm-hmm. first cousin to these rich brothers, whose mother was somebody called Penelope Devereux, who was also a very strong Elizabethan character. But anyway, she is also a descendant of Mary Boleyn. I mean, she's a direct descendant of Mary Boleyn. And she is sort of, at one point I call her the last Boleyn girl. She is quite amazing. She's very, very sexy woman. Very attracted to power, and to be attracted to power means you have to be near powerful men, of course, in those days. When Henrietta Maria first comes in England, she's told that, you know, that Lucy Carlyle's hoping to be Charles's mistress. But anyway, Charles isn't interested in having a mistress, so that doesn't work out. But she is the mistress of his most powerful minister, the Duke of Buckingham. But she becomes very close to the Queen. At first, they start off as sort of not liking each other, but they become very close. She's good company, Lucy Carlyle. She gives great funny dinner parties. You know, she's not... Henrietta Maria doesn't like people who are a bit snobby and dull and snooty. She likes to, you know, relax and have fun and, you know, gossip and do things like that. And Lucy Carlyle's great at that. And both of them are interested in, you know, are political players, and Lucy is very much that. She's a Protestant, although she lives a rather sort of naughty lifestyle. And, you know, Duke of Buckingham is a married man she's having an affair with. You know, she's no she saint, mm-hmm. as she later becomes called. But she is also a Protestant who has sympathies with the Puritan cause. And is anti-Spanish, and in fact she has, that's what she has in common with Henrietta Maria at the beginning, is they're both anti-Spanish. Henrietta Maria because she's French, Later on, she's also, Buckingham is murdered. She becomes close to another of Charles's most powerful ministers, a man called Thomas Wentworth, Earl of Strafford. And she's very close to him. He is then executed, rather unfortunately, actually by Parliament, essentially. She then becomes close to the king's enemy, John Pym, who's a Puritan MP in Parliament. And she begins, having been the Queen's closest friend, she starts shifting and it actually becomes very close to Parliament. And just before the Civil War, she basically becomes a spy for Charles and Henrietta Maria's enemies. And they only realise this on the point when they have to flee London just before the Civil War. Mm-hmm. During the Civil War, when Henrietta Maria is writing letters in code, she uses as her own code name the name Lucy Carlyle, really as a sort of mark of, you know, contempt for her former friend. Mm-hmm. But then, during the Civil War, the revolution moves leftward, and eventually Lucy Carlyle feels she doesn't want to be part of this revolution anymore, and she becomes a royalist again. Mm-hmm. And during what's called the Second Civil War, she's a spy for the king. And so when the king is executed, she is in fact in the Tower of London, like her great-great-great-great aunt, you know, Anne Boleyn, before her. Mm-hmm. But unlike Anne, she isn't beheaded. Mm-hmm. I won't say what her fate is, but it is really quite a sort of classic moment, her ultimate fate. So I'll leave that for readers to discover.
Yes, so buy the book. And then I have another question about kind of bringing, I have two more main, actually maybe there's three here. The idea, they kind of go together, of his name, why he was called the White King. And also the idea of kind of the propaganda around them. I wanted to see if you could talk a little bit about just these myths around him and the propaganda against him was the one kind of area that I wanted to touch on. And then the other one, you talked about these players who were also involved in the Americas. And this is interesting because we actually see some role that the New World had in the politics of England at this point, with some of the colonies being involved in supporting the different players. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that too. So those are the two main other areas I wanted to ask you about.
Okay, yes. Okay, so the White King. Charles was crowned. He was wearing a white satin suit with a sort of purple mantle. But a sort of myth grew up that he'd been entirely dressed in white and that he was the first king of England ever to have been crowned in white. This wasn't in fact true, as he was wearing the same clothes his father had worn. But why would this become invented? And again, I think it was a part of a sort of propaganda thing. So during the Civil War, Charles's enemies said, you know, that he was the White King of prophecy, that there were prophecies of a White King who would be a tyrant who would be destroyed by his own people. Mm. And that's what they said. He was the White King of the prophecies of Merlin. Mm. But then his supporters said, no, that's not true. He's the White King because these white robes represent his innocence, his purity, his goodness, and the fact that he was prepared to die as a martyr for his people. And then when he after he's executed, he's buried at Windsor Castle in the chapel, and there's supposed to be a snowstorm as he's carried out of the hall of Windsor Castle to St. George's Chapel, and the white snow covers the black velvet pall, turning it white. And a witness who's there says, you know, and so, you know, the White King went to his grave, eventually, you know, in this snowy pool. In fact, I suspect that story was invented by this man who was a parliamentarian, who was very key, who wrote it during the reign of Charles II, was keen to suck up to Charles II, you know, and was a professional liar. So whether there was actually snow, we don't know. But that's all a part, again, of, as you say, the propaganda and the myths that surround Charles. There's the myth that he was controlled by his wife. There's the myth that he was a sort of physically puny specimen. He's always made to appear sort of rather effeminate. But actually, you know, he produced a brood of children that Henry VIII, who actually suffered from impotence, could only have envied. You know, as I said, he was a physically strong, healthy man who... you know, loved women and had mistresses before he married. He didn't, and he actually did have a mistress after he married as well. He'd been separated forcibly from Henrietta Maria for a number of years. He had a liaison, we know about, with a red-haired royalist spy who he tried to meet actually in his, you know, closet. In his, you know, basically his bathroom lavatory when he was shut up in Carisbrooke Castle. And he writes very, you know, blunt letters about how he wants to, you know, have sex with her, you know, in quite, you know, direct language, let's put it like that. So again, that's another sort of myth about Charles, I think, that he's sort of, you know, sort of weakling, effeminate. That, you know, that also that he didn't have support, that he was unpopular. Yes, he was unpopular with some, but he was hugely popular with others. Mm-hmm. And also, I think, you know, he learned from his mistakes. So he became a rather good leader in battle, for example, during the Civil War. And he was loved in a way, when he died, he was loved in a way that his son, the merry monarch Charles II, never would be. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's worth remembering about Charles. So what was your next question?
It's the role of the new world, in that this is the first time you start to see, well, not that, that there's this kind of link now, and the colonies take an interest in what's going on, obviously.
Yes. No, I find it absolutely fascinating. Very much so. A lot of the opposition to Charles, early in his reign are linked to the American colonies, of course, the Puritans.
Right.
So not surprisingly so. As I said, you have people like, you know, Robert Rich, Earl of Warwick, who is, you know, a leading opponent to the king in Parliament, who's a great investor in the American colonies. During the 11 years when Charles was ruling without Parliament, many of Charles's opponents, including Oliver Cromwell, were thinking of emigrating to the colonies. But then the wars with Scotland began, and literally just at the moment they were all about to get on the boat, practically. That changed. And instead, what happened, which I find quite fascinating, is a number of people who had previously gone to the colonies and had made lives for them there, came back. Mm-hmm. You had, for example, one of the governors of Harvard College came back and became a leading figure. He became the sort of leading chaplain of the New Model Army. Mm. And was there at Charles's trial and, you know, gave sermons you know, just before Charles's execution, was a very important figure. And there were many others who were leading captains fighting in the war, so forth. I mean, there were obviously royalists too, which I unfortunately know less about. I'd like to do more research on those, because of course Maryland is named after Henrietta Maria, who was known as Queen Mary. So I'd be interested in studying more about Maryland actually in the future. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
If anyone wants to send me stuff about Maryland. Perfect.
Great. Well, you have answered all of my questions, And I want to now also give you an opportunity to talk about where people can get your books and learn more about your work. And I'm sure everybody who's watching this has at least seen your books, but if you can just share a little bit about the books that you've written and what you're working on now, and where people can catch more of you.
Well, I have a website, a rather sort of simple website, leanderdelisle.com, and you can see all my books there, and indeed as a podcast as well, 10 Minute Tudors, if you're interested in that. What else do I have on that website? Oh, and I've got a link to a couple of lectures, I think, as well on YouTube. There's one on Lady Jane Grey you might all like, which I did when I was involved with the BBC series about her. So yes, the books are all there. As I said, there's one on Elizabeth's rivals, Lady Jane Grey and her sisters. Many people don't know about Lady Jane Grey's sisters, and that seems to be a popular book with readers.
That was the inspiration for Philippa Gregory's novel, right?
That's right. Yes, it was. Yes, absolutely. Yes, it was. Which was very kind of her to point that out. Yes, absolutely, it was. I've written a book on the whole dynasty. Mm-hmm. Beginning right back before the Battle of Bosworth, right in the middle of the 15th century, so long before just Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn, mm-hmm. called Tudor, The Family Story, mm-hmm. Which focuses on all the family members, really. Mm-hmm. So I hope your readers might enjoy that. Mm-hmm. There's one on the death of Elizabeth and the accession of King James. And then there's this latest one, The White King, The Tragedy of Charles I, which is about Charles, and you can read some bits about them on my website, and you can buy them. I think it has links with there's Amazon, of course, obviously, but there are also lots of independent bookshops, Waterstones, and many others, and if they haven't got one in stock, I'm sure they can order it. All these books are in print. Yes, I think that's
yeah, no, that's perfect. And I'll put links all around on the web page where this is showing as well, so people can look. There's probably going to be links down here somewhere below the video, so everybody can look there. Perfect. Thank you so much for being so generous with your time and for sharing so much with us about Charles I. I learned a lot from your book. And like you said, after I got done reading it, I thought, well, why did I not? It's almost like you said, the bookends of the Tudor dynasty with the Wars of the Roses over here on this side. And you can't really understand the early Tudors unless you understand the Wars of the Roses. And then the later Tudors, the end, the culmination of it all here in the English.
That's exactly right. It begins with the Civil War and it ends with the Civil War, interestingly. Yes, thank you. Yeah. That's a very good point.
Yeah. No, so I really enjoyed learning more about that. So thank you for that. Cool. I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you very much.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.